who's hoping.
Thanks, Dean.
Hi, I'm Sophie Amanadic.
Hi, Sophie.
Thanks for asking me to see the chair, Dave. Yeah, good to be of service. It's quite a while since I've been to this meeting. Congratulations on your 1 year, and thanks for your share. God, I'm so nervous. I went out and I prayed, and hopefully it helped, but I still feel as nervous. My body aches, I've got so much fear going on. And it's okay, you know, it's like every time I do a chair, I feel the fear, and I do it anyway. One of the clichés of NA. I guess I want to start by saying I'm also celebrating a sobriety birthday, or clean time birthday. I was 10 years clean on Tuesday. It's really, really good to be clean, and I'm incredibly grateful, and you know, welcome to any newcomers, and just welcome to anyone that's come back from a relapse, or just welcome, hello. I guess I also want to say that from when I first tried to get clean, which was in 2002, I was removed from the area that I was using in, and I was picked up by my sister, who came looking for me, and she found me, and I tried to get clean, and at that point, for me, with no understanding about the disease of addiction, I thought that just by putting down heroin and crack, I was clean. And so I carried on drinking and smoking. And I tried to do a home detox, and I lasted about 6 days, and then I'd drink. And I went back out, as they say, and I had a full-blown relapse for about 8 months. That early experience of trying to get clean, a huge amount of denial. I mean, I was homeless for 2 years before my sister came and picked me up. I was using every day. If I wasn't using a drug, although when I, you know, talk about like prescribed drugs, I know there's no difference, but when I wasn't using street drugs, I was using prescribed drugs, and I was buying them off the street as well. So it was just anything that I could get my hands on, really, and alcohol was there as well. And so when I first engaged with like a community drug project, they put me on naltrexone, and they also wanted to put me on antabuse, which is a blocker for alcohol. And I just, you know, I was just like, I don't need antabuse. There was just absolutely no way, no acceptance whatsoever. And it made no difference putting me on naltrexone, because I carried on using anyway, and nearly killed myself because I went over at the wheel on the M25, and you know, ended up in a mess. So, you know, the power of the illness. I didn't want to stop, and I remember a family member saying to me at the time, you know, what is it going to take for you to realise just how bad you are? You know, is it going to take for you to end up in prison? And 8 months later, I was in prison. And you know, when I first came into recovery, it wasn't that long after coming into recovery, You know, I went, you know, I spent a period of time in prison, and I went straight from prison into treatment. And I see that relapse was part of my process and my journey, and it wasn't until I got into treatment and I could look at that, and I could then see that alcohol was the first thing that I went to, and the rest followed. So the denial, I kind of got my step one, if nothing else, when I was in treatment, and I learned and I understood that in order for me to have any chance of a different way of life, then I had to knock everything on the head. And I was crystal clear about that by the time I left treatment. And you know, 10 years and 4 days down the line, here I am. I remember coming out of treatment and having massive using dreams the night I moved into third stage, and was absolutely baffled as to why that could be, because I'd just done 7 months in treatment. And they've happened along the way, and you know, I understand more. So kind of going back to the prison, it's like, when I was in prison, I didn't see it as an intervention of higher power at all, not one bit. What I could say in hindsight is that it absolutely saved my life. Overdoses were a regular part of my using, and in the last, in that final 8 month relapse before I went into prison, I lost count of the amount of overdoses that I had, and. You know, there was 1 week, and I know some of you have heard this before, but some of you won't have done, so I'll share it. But there was one particular week where I overdosed three times in 1 week, and on two occasions it was the same ambulance team that picked me up and took me to the hospital, and I would, you know, I came round and I just left, and I left the hospital and I went and used. You know, on one occasion, because I'd got robbed once I'd gone over in this person's flat, I then had to deal with the dealer who just, like, rammed this massive candle wax, you know, candle in my head, you know, because he'd lost all his drugs. And so, you know, that's another tip of a story in terms of the amount of violence that I experienced in my using. I was surrounded by desperate addicts. You know, we've all done desperate things to get our drugs. And it was in that last 8 month relapse, which is probably the most violent time. I was robbed on a number of occasions, and sometimes it was like the drugs were punched out of my mouth. I've had knives put to my throat. I've had this one particular guy who put a cigarette out on my forehead and then pepper sprayed me whilst having a knife to my throat, trying to rob me. So, you know, I came in pretty traumatised when I actually went into treatment. And I've shared this frequently, but... you know, the harms through the violence in my using stopped me from talking and approaching to men for about the first 4 years of my recovery. And there is one particular person that springs to mind in this room who's very aware of that. And I won't look at them. But I was just like, I know I can't swear, so I'll mime it, but to anyone, really, I was just like, you know, do not come near me. Because I was terrified, absolutely terrified, and I could not, you know, I could not shift that perspective of seeing, in this instance, a man in any other way other than completely violent and abusive. And... you know, and if I'm being really honest, it's still stuff I have to work on today. But I've got a lot better. You know, the one of the gifts, actually, You know, we hear a lot about the spiritual principles of this program, and trust is one that has never come easily for me, and it's one that I've had to really practice in practicing. I have to make a really concerted effort to move to a place of trust and remain open to that. And I met this man who we became very good friends, and it really restored my faith in believing that you can have a friendship with a man who doesn't want anything, etc. But I also need to say that, you know, my experiences in my relationships way before I got into addiction, in terms of active drug addiction, I always found it hard to... I sort of avoided relationships with the opposite gender. So it's not just about what went on in my using. That was there before. But again, you know, through the gift of working these steps and getting a much deeper understanding of addiction, I've been able to look at my part in that and, you know, try and make changes. I came into recovery. The period of relapses served me well. As I said, I learned a lot, which has stood me in good stead. And I am 100% crystal clear that I never want to go back to where I came from. Absolutely no way. And I, you know, it took, when I went into treatment, I'd lost my voice. That first couple of days I was there, in one respect, being honest, because I'd just come out of prison, it was heaven. I was just like, thank God I'm not in prison anymore. I was diagnosed HIV positive when I was in prison, and you know, it wasn't a smooth ride. I'd been tested the 8 months previously, and I was negative, so I wasn't expecting it at all. And you know, that's been a journey. I have to say, it's also been a gift, because it's now my career. I've travelled. I've spoken at world conferences about it. I do a lot of work with prisons and advocating for people who are living in prison with HIV. Living with and accepting took about 5 years, and you know, I've been living with it for about 10 and a half years now. You know, I've gone through periods of not sharing that at all, and then sharing it. And, you know, even now, it's like I've just taken a risk, because there are people in the fellowship that live with other long-term conditions, and they live with this condition. And, you know, I just, it's a part of me, and a part. But I've experienced incredible discrimination around that. Really, really abusive. And unfortunately, it's been from people in recovery. And so, you know, I don't really know where I'm going. You know, we all have our experiences. You know, I've learned from them, and as I said, it came out. I always decide whether I'm going to share about it or not. You know, and it's like I work for a charity, which is, you know, it's like the therapeutic value of one addict helping another. Well, it's the therapeutic person of another colleague living with HIV supporting, you know, I had somebody come into the prison who was a woman living with HIV, had been a, you know, former drug user. peer support, therapeutic value. She ended up being my sponsor for a while. She gave me a blue book when I was in prison, and it went in my drawer for 7 months. And eventually came out at one point when I'd gone into treatment. Reading a book, impossible, when I was in prison. Anyway, so I went to my first NA meeting when I was in treatment, and it was a woman. I felt very inspired, and the one thing I took away from that meeting is just keep coming back, and that's what I've done. I ran to meetings for the first 18 months because I was so terrified that if I stopped, I'd use. And there's times when I've done 90 meetings in 90 days and really understood the word commitment, just in one form. But, you know, in another way, I kind of know that I've always been totally committed to my recovery because I just never, ever want to go back to where I came from. So on some level, it's really simple for me. I was resistant through... for a number of reasons, but mainly because I didn't trust the process, and it didn't matter how much I heard people sharing at meetings about how much their life had changed, not only through working the steps, but just other things as well, but fundamentally that message of the action of working the steps. I didn't trust it. And also I just didn't believe that I was worthy of that. But I kept coming to meetings. And, you know, I had a lot of arrogance. Without being hard on myself, I did. You know, I didn't start working the steps until I was about 18 months clean. And I'd hear people say that just coming to meetings isn't enough. So I did that until it got to the point where it was so painful that I started working the steps. And that's not a recommendation coming from me. But I started working the steps, and I always say this, for me, and I don't believe for 1 minute I'm alone with this, but the only thing that's given me the most understanding and clarity about the disease of addiction is through working the steps. I think the way that they're written is incredible, and just what it draws out from us, and... you know, my former sponsor is here today. She's sitting in front of me. And she was my sponsor for 7 years? 7 years, something like that. And, you know, she's listening to my steps. And I'm actually sitting here, and I can recall us sitting in your house reading out my step one. I remember the weekend we spent doing my step four and five. And, you know, I did them. I have to say, and I've said this before, because I bounced off the walls for 10 months writing my step four. And I found step six more painful, personally. I was acting out a lot in my step four, or leading up to my step four. But, you know, the first time round when I worked the steps, it was step six. Because I'd heard the language about shortcomings and defects of character, but I didn't really understand, for some of them, how, you know, I could understand how dishonesty would impact on another person being able to trust me. Denial, control. But, you know, it wasn't until... I had to reach out to other members of the fellowship to help me to get that real clear understanding of what it felt like to be on the end of me in my using, or even not using and still being on the receiving end of me. And I really connected emotionally to that stuff. And I remember in my early recovery... there were huge amounts of envy that came up and jealousy. I'd, you know, really compare myself against others, and I wanted what they had and couldn't see that they'd worked. I'm not talking just about people in the rooms, actually, more actually people outside of the rooms, but I had this sort of like deserving attitude that I should have that, and, you know, like they'd worked 15 odd years to achieve what they had, and I just wanted it like that, the instant gratification. And I mean, I'm not going to sit here and because I can't think of all of them, but I just remember that jealousy and envy were really, really there for me, and probably greed, and other ones, but and then they went, you know, it's like the step 6 and 7, and I did get real relief from those particular defects of character after, you know, working through those steps. What's really interesting is that they're really coming, well, jealousy, actually, around relationships. Not, I am in a relationship, I'm in a very loving relationship, and the jealousy isn't being acted out in that relationship, it's actually acting out in work. There's a difference in that I am, in terms of the intensity of the feeling, I recognise that it's really historical, whereas once before I'd just be like, why? You know, this is just blowing me off the planet. But it's still really hard not to, or I have to really practice not acting that out inappropriately in the workplace, which is, anyone who knows me, I'm quite volatile at times, and you know, I have to work really hard at containing my anger, and it is manifesting in anger as well. And you know, it's like that unmanageability, you know, where it talks about in step 2. My very first sponsor said to me, you know, you don't understand about the unmanageability. And I was like, no, I don't. And she was like, you'll learn more. And I hadn't heard of, you know, emotional unmanageability. And that's something that still goes on for me today. I mean, my therapist says that I still fear feelings. And I was quite gutted because I think I've come a long way in just allowing myself to feel stuff. But I do find it quite overwhelming at times. So even 10 years on, there's the emotional unmanageability. You know, I'm working through the steps in another fellowship at the moment, and I think what, again, the change, and this is from working the programme, you know, to the best of my ability, is working these steps in the other fellowship is a completely different experience because I trust it more, because I have that previous experience. And when I did my 4 and 5 recently, I knew the freedom that I was getting. I knew the freedom that was coming from doing that searching moral inventory. And I got it. I mean, I got freedom after doing the first 3 steps, to be honest. It was, you know, and when we move on, when we put the drugs down and our addiction starts playing out in other areas of our lives, all areas of our lives, actually, for me it was relationships, family relationships, intimate relationships, work relationships, and I needed to go into another fellowship to address this stuff, and it's been another gift. There was a point, 2008, when there was just, it was like another rock bottom in recovery, and it was around relationships, and I had to let go of some friends who had been a fundamental part of my recovery up to that point, because the thing that kept on coming up was this disappointment and letdown and disappointment. That was just what kept on coming back, and somebody who's, you know, almost like 30 years in recovery now was like, learn to value the feeling of disappointment, and I will still do my utmost to avoid it, I have to say. You know, so I had to look at, like, why was it that I was continuing to engage with people who actually the most familiar feeling that they left me with was let down and disappointment. So I let go. The relationship with my parents had, you know, just a brief history on that. I keep on keeping an eye on the time. I didn't see my parents for 17 years, and I had to wait 3 years into recovery before I saw them. It was a suggestion when I was in treatment, and I took it on board. That is a gift. Because one of my biggest fears, because my parents are elderly, especially my father, was that I would never get to make amends to them. And I've got to make living amends to them since being in recovery. But I can't remember all the ins and outs, but, you know, I remember talking to my sponsor about it, and, it was just a really horrendous year. And I think that the absolute icing on the cake was I ended up having to go into hospital to have quite major surgery. And I never heard anything from them. There was no card, there was no visit. And I was absolutely devastated. And so another level of recovery had to sort of start in that area. And then the following, at the end of that year, things really changed through my dad becoming ill, and he had a stroke in 2009-10. I've got to make, from that, I've been able to make ongoing living amends to my parents by showing up as a daughter and everything that encompasses that, really. It's one of those situations that you wouldn't ask for, that it happened in those circumstances, but it did. And where I come from and with our history, I have at least some peace that I've got this opportunity, I've been given this opportunity to make amends towards them. And so I've kind of lost my train of thought. So let's talk a bit about higher power. I wouldn't be sitting here if it wasn't for the fact that I believe in a higher power. I came into the fellowship as an atheist. Growing up, I always had this belief that there was something far greater, and that manifested in the nature. And, you know, I grew up in the countryside and was just surrounded by this beauty, really. When I was in treatment, my higher power was this massive oak tree in the garden. And I was in there from so I saw autumn, winter, spring and summer. So I just saw this tree change, and it was a magnificent tree. You have to see it. But that was my higher power. And I remember the therapist in second stage making this suggestion. No, it's the first stage manager. And he said about prayer. And I literally spat the words back at him. I said, "What do you mean, pray?" And actually, prayer has become one of the most powerful tools for me in recovery. Absolutely one of the most powerful tools. Whenever it comes to issues around health, I have to say that my will takes over massively. I know I'm going to contradict myself here, but this is where a daily program comes in. I really understand the meaning of just for today, because this is all I have. But when I was told that I would need to have surgery at the end of 2008, I stopped praying. I was absolutely terrified. I was terrified about the fact that I would have to be put under, and that I would be on, you know, high level of drugs post-operatively, and I was. I guess at that time I ran on blind faith. I got through it. I picked up a phone. I spoke to people every day in the fellowship. This really good friend of mine, I probably spoke to you as well. Sarah came up. Again, this was no family came up. Sarah came up and was there as I was wheeled into theatre. My twin came up post-operatively, you know, but I think I just felt the fact that my parents, and it like a bit further down the line, my sister said, I don't think they didn't realise how serious it was. Anyway, so heavy. So, yeah, the sort of, you know, the blind faith and then also, as I said earlier, much earlier on, it's like I really see the intervention of something far greater than myself being sent to prison, because if I hadn't gone to prison, I wouldn't have known about my HIV. And not through my HIV, I don't know, but I would probably be dead by now because of how kind of violent my using was and the amount of overdoses that I was having towards the end. You know, and if we talk about some of the more subtle ways that this disease manifests, you know, it's been in self-esteem, it's been in, you know, this is the disease of sabotage. And again, way before my real active drug addiction took over, I was sabotaging myself through in my studies. You know, I underachieved. And so one of the gifts that recovery has given me is I feel like I'm making up for lost time. And although I've done some studying in recovery, I've worked really hard to sort of get where I am on my career ladder. And being in that position of being diagnosed in prison, you know, prison is such an oppressive place, and it was such a disempowering, it felt so disempowering. You know, I'm quite a tenacious person, and I kind of had to turn such a negative experience around. I hate feeling disempowered. I hate feeling powerless. So the way that I learned to come to accept and deal with my diagnosis was to get empowered, to get knowledge. Same way I had to about the disease of addiction, and I continue to have to. And as I said, it's become my career. I kind of have other hats as well, but I've worked in the sector for 9 years, and as I said, it's taken me the opportunities. I'm flying out to Cape Town in December because I now sit on a global advisory board for key populations, which is drug users and people who are in prison. And that's such a, you know, I get blown away by it, actually. I really do. I'm like, wow. And part of that is, you know, is that sort of self-doubt that creeps in. It's hard to say this, but it's like I am considered an expert, but I find that really hard to absorb and take on board. But, you know, that's the situation. So I'm sorry. Situation's the right word, but you know what I mean. And, you know, it's like I always grapple with sharing the good stuff. Because you're perceived as being arrogant, or you know, you're not humble or whatever, and I work flipping hard. I think a lot of us do to get where we are, and I think the more you lose, the more you play catch up. So I just say it hopefully to give people hope. You know, it's like, you know, I used to be a nurse. I had a career. When I first got clean, because of prison and all the criminal convictions and whatever, I believed that I was unemployable. I had no self-esteem, no self-worth. Wow. And that's changed. You know, that I have self-esteem. I value myself. I know I am of worth. You know, this... this is an inside job. And as much as I am aware and I can still look for all that external validation and stuff, I'm a human being, it's a human default. It's a lot more measured these days, because I do have enough love of myself and enough value of myself. And the biggest thing around this has been around my status. Because, like, I don't need another person to accept me, because I can accept myself. And if you can't accept that, bye. I'm not gonna fill up my space with people who are gonna feel that they have the right to judge me on any way, shape, or form. I've been through too much, you know. And I love myself enough to just tell them to jog on. Go and judge someone else. Sponsorship. I'm running out of time, but it's classic, isn't it? All the really valuable stuff. Sponsorship is an absolute privilege. I think we've all experienced it. But my experience is the first time I ever sponsored one, I was so full of doubt and I didn't believe that I knew enough about the disease of addiction to share that with another. And my sponsor said, yeah, you do. So I just did it. And wow, it's, you know, it is such a privilege. I am always of service, whether that be through the end of the telephone, whether it be in a meeting, whether it be through being a sponsor. We can only keep what we have by giving it away. I can only keep what I have by giving it away. And I really, you know, I think a really gentle thing for me, because I'm very critical of myself at times, is really grasping that concept of just for today and keeping it in the day and doing the best that I can. And I have not so good days, politely putting it, and I have amazing days, really amazing days. My life has transformed. I'm probably in the best place I've ever been in my recovery, actually. Life is really good. Life is really good. And I'm proud that I get to show up, not just for myself, but for other people as well. Because when when we start to kind of learn about the level of the self-centeredness of this illness and how we think that we've been there for others, but there's generally been a motive on our part, it's nice to be able to do it without a motive, and that I'm showing up because I want to. You know, I'm trying to do good for another. So thank you for letting me share. Thanks.